Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's not a perfect ceasefire, but thousands of displaced Lebanese are streaming toward home today, over cratered roads to ruined villages in the south of Lebanon. In Israel, the rain of Hezbollah rockets has stopped for now, as both sides count their losses. Hezbollah pamphlets have already claimed divine victory in the bloody month of fighting. In Israel, a tough accounting has begun. "We did not fail," said Israel's interior minister. Hezbollah has taken a pummeling, but it survives. And then there's this, the war beyond this war, the undeclared proxy war, strategists say, goes on between the U.S. and Iran. Up next on Point, ceasefire, prospects now, and the proxy war in the Middle East. We go first today for the latest from the largely quiet front lines in Israel and Lebanon to look at how the ceasefire is unfolding. Joining me now from the town of Qana in southern Lebanon is Thanasi Kambanis, Middle East Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. Thanasi, thanks for being with us. What's it look like there?
Well, it's a bit of a messy bag here. There's thousands and thousands of refugees who are pouring back to their homes today, creating traffic jams all along the southern highways. But at the same time, among the euphoria, there's also a lot of tension. I've seen more Hezbollah fighters out in the open today than at any point in the last 3 weeks that I've been around southern Lebanon. They seem weary, but also flush with a sense of victory. They believe that they succeeded in keeping Israel from penetrating as deeply into their territory as they wanted, and by their open displays of their presence on the streets here today, they're saying we're still here, and the minute they see Israel breaking a ceasefire, they are ready to respond. And I'll also note we tried to head to the border about an hour ago and got turned back by a gunfight between Hezbollah and Israeli soldiers, and we did see a wounded Hezbollah soldier being brought to a clinic in Tabin from that gunfight. So although it's been, as you said, a largely quiet day of truce, there are still flare-ups like this, which many people are afraid could lead to something, a larger conflagration.
Thanasi, what is the picture of then of control at this point? How deep into Lebanon are the Israelis in general? What's the deepest penetration? Did they get anywhere near the Latani River that was this spoken of? What's the topography as the guns fall quiet?
Israel has tried to capture strategic hilltops, and they certainly did not get as deeply into South Lebanon as they had declared they wanted to a few weeks ago. At one point, they've reached the Latani, but for the most of the length of the Latani, they're nowhere near it. What we see is more like the front line I saw today around the town of Ghanduria, which you might have heard of in the news. It's next to Taibe, where several Israeli tanks were disabled by Hezbollah fighters. What you see there is on one hilltop, a town controlled by Hezbollah, on the next hilltop, a town that has Israeli ground forces in it. And I'd say they're about 2 miles apart across a valley, and it's not at all a straight line. I mean, if you looked at a map of southern Lebanon, you'd have to draw a very rough zigzag to capture all the towns that Israel is in, many of which are surrounded on three sides by Hezbollah-controlled towns.
So almost a patchwork. What are the Lebanese that you're speaking with saying? Do they expect this ceasefire to hold? Do they expect Hezbollah to, in fact, pull back, at least militarily, from this area bordering Israel? Or do they expect more fighting to come?
Well, as always, you have to make a distinction between what people say and what they're doing. We hear a lot of mistrust voice about Israel. Typical is a man I just interviewed who said, I don't trust the Israelis. I expect anything from them. I expect them to bomb us again any day. On the other hand, here in Qana, he had just brought his family back home, clearly convinced that after 3 weeks where they had sought safety in central Lebanon, that it was safe for them to come home. And the smiles on people's faces and the fact that they are returning with their families to their dwelling suggests to me that they believe it's safe to come back.
Does Hezbollah look like a reduced force, a reduced power in Lebanon?
I think it's hard to characterize it that way, partly because of the political capital they have achieved inside Lebanon as a result of this war, and partly because of the fact that it seems like most of their fighters have survived. Now, it's impossible to quantify that. I don't know that for a fact any more than any analyst who would claim the opposite, but I've been through frontline towns in South Lebanon over and over the last 4 weeks, and I see the same men, the same fighters each time I come. The same commanders, the same village chiefs, and the same teenage fighters under their command, which suggests to me that the backbone of this force is still standing.
And finally, Tanasi, you're there in Kana, where the bombs famously fell that killed so many civilians, a day that really shook up world opinion about the war. What's the attitude there? Are people going to move right back in? Will all of this area be repopulated within days or weeks?
Well, the people of Kana pride themselves in representing the spirit of southern Lebanon, and it is a Shiite culture that both embraces death and seems to rebound quite quickly from it. After 1996, they rebuilt with incredible speed towns destroyed during that Israeli offensive, and people here say they intend to do the same now. In one town in outside of Saida, Hezbollah engineers were already drawing up plans to rebuild. Here in Kana, people are coming home. I see generators on the street outside of houses, people throwing away rotting food that they left behind in a hurry 3 weeks ago, and they seem determined to return to normalcy as quickly as possible.
Tanasi Kambanis in Kana in southern Lebanon, thank you very much for being with us.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Bureau chief there for the Boston Globe. We turn now to Israel and to Stephen Erlanger, Jerusalem bureau chief for the New York Times. Stephen Erlanger, thank you very much for joining us. How are Israelis responding to the ceasefire? It's fact in the news.
They're responding with a great deal of caution. There are a lot of Israelis who don't believe that it's going to hold. There are a lot of people who don't believe that Nasrallah wants to leave the south of Lebanon and don't believe that an expanded UNIFIL is going to work with the Lebanese army to disarm Hezbollah in the south. That's what the UN resolution says, but there's a lot of skepticism about it.
And what about the government? The prime minister has been speaking to the country, the parliament, the Knesset. Is he hanging up a mission accomplished banner?
Well, yes. No, I mean, his first statement was about destroying Hezbollah, and that I'm sure he wishes he could take back, because you can't destroy a broadly based political movement that lives among civilians. It can't be destroyed. I mean, what you can do is diminish it, and what you can do is create an international coalition to stop it from confronting Israel again. And in that sense, I think Olmert believes that he's accomplished a task. Whether it will last or not, nobody really knows.
And yet you write there's a lot of debate about this within Israel. You quote Nahum Barnea, a columnist with the country's largest paper, Yediot Aharonot, forgive my pronunciation, but writing, "We did not win," that Israel comes to the ceasefire bruised, conflicted, and disturbed. What's that debate?
Well, the debate is not about the justification for the war. People think the war was justified. The debate is about the way it was carried out and why the government waited so long to unleash the army. That's the usual view. Everyone understands that no army is ready to fight suddenly right away. It took the Americans a long time to get ready to fight in Iraq. And that, 10 days of air war made sense. But no one ever believed the air power would get rid of the 10,000 Katyusha rockets, which are the small ones that have been driving Israelis into bomb shelters in south from the north, and that required taking ground. And the debate is over why the government waited as long as it did, and should it have waited that long, and should it have planned it differently, and did it really know what it was doing? And that's a lot of the debate. And part of the debate is also about Israeli self-image. Israelis like to think that they win big wars in short periods of time. In fact, the last Lebanon war took 18 years, and Israel withdrew unilaterally. So it's hard. won that war either. But there's a lot of concern about deterrence here, because many Israelis see this as not a little battle between Hezbollah and Israel, but between a division of an Iranian army, which was Hezbollah, and Israel, and see it as a sort of proxy battle with radical Shia Islam, which the Americans are fighting in Iraq and in Afghanistan and elsewhere.
And the expectation, Stephen, in the minute we have left here for the weeks and months ahead, is there some hope, any hope, confidence that Lebanese plus international troops will quiet this area of southern Lebanon?
I think so, yes. I mean, I do expect there will be skirmishes, but I do expect things to quiet down. I mean, the big question will be, you know, will Syria and Iran be able to resupply Hezbollah? Will Hezbollah actually leave the south as it's supposed to do, south of the Litani River? And will this expanded UNIFIL with the Lebanese army, if it ever goes down south, get rid of the armaments that Hezbollah has there? These are all to be seen, but I think Hezbollah is not eager to go through this kind of war again. And I don't think the people of Lebanon are terribly eager for Hezbollah to drag them into this kind of war again. So my assumption is that it will get quiet for at least some long time to come.
Stephen Erlanger, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Steve, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Joining me now from Tel Aviv is Daniel Levy. He's director of the Middle East Initiative at the New America Foundation and Century Foundation. He was a member of the official Israeli negotiating team at the Oslo and Taba talks, lead Israeli drafter of the Geneva Initiative. Daniel Levy, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Washington, David Schenker joins us. He's senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. From 2002 to 2006, he was the Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and Palestinian Affairs Advisor in the Office of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. David Schenker, thank you for joining us.
Good to be here.
Daniel Levy, first to you, what do you make of the ceasefire and where things stand at this point? Is it too soon or too late to be talking about who's won and who's lost? What's your interpretation of this moment?
There are not always clear outcomes in military confrontations, and this one will largely be played out now in the spin, the perceptions, the images, and in the implementation, of course, of UN Resolution 1701. I can tell you that many Israelis are certainly pleased to know that the residents of the north can return to their homes and come out of the shelters. I think much will depend on the next steps. There are some things we can say already at this stage. It's not easy to fight a well-armed guerrilla force. I think others have learnt that before us. Mm. I think it's good that Israel has got out of this situation after 4 weeks with some significant diplomatic achievements. And I think that's the important point, that the military here, there are limits to what you can achieve in the military realm. We always knew there would have to be a diplomatic, political outcome to this, and that's where it's going to be tested now. Hezbollah, on the one hand, has clearly suffered losses. On the other hand, has clearly increased its image, its popularity in the Arab and Muslim world. The daily images have helped in that. I think that has probably, and this is a terrible and probably unintended consequence, done something to strengthen the Iranian regime of Ahmadinejad. Having said that, I imagine many Lebanese and Shia will return home, see the destruction, and not be too happy at all at what they see. Mm.
David Schenker, your analysis of the sort of ceasefire moment calculus here, gains and losses, how do you see it?
Well, I'm not sanguine about the UN resolution. I think the idea that you would have an expanded UNIFIL, an organization that has proven ineffective for decades, that would be expanded and that be the key, is not particularly reason for optimism. Likewise, the resolution is so vague. You have the Israelis on one hand who say that they're going to stay in southern Lebanon. Hezbollah says they'll continue to confront occupation. And that is not clear whether they're talking about the Israelis in Lebanon or the Israelis' occupation, quote-unquote, of Sheba Farms. And if they're talking about Sheba, which I believe they are, you've ended where you started. This is the starting point, obviously, that the UN has said that Israel has done a full withdrawal from Lebanon. This is prior to the last month's war. And Hezbollah continued to consider this to be Lebanese-occupied territory, when in fact the international community viewed it as Syrian-occupied territory. So I'm not particularly pleased. I also believe that, as Daniel noted, that Iran and Syria have emerged from this in good shape. Iran has confronted Israel, if even only indirectly, and Syria has started to reemerge from international isolation, something that the international community did a very good job of isolating Syria after the assassination of former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri in February 2005. So I'm not sanguine at all about where we've ended up.
David Shanker, let me ask you. Charles Krauthammer wrote a week or 10 days ago about the conflict. He reminded readers, the conservative columnist, Washington Post, reminded readers that in 1982, American-made Israeli fighters engaged the Syrian Air Force and shot down 86 MiG fighters without a single loss. Just a tremendous, very fast blow, part of the kind of Israeli reputation for hitting hard and fast. He wrote on August 5th, America wants, America needs a decisive Hezbollah defeat. Did it get it?
No, it didn't get it. I think initially the Israelis were under the misimpression that they could denigrate Hezbollah's military capabilities in a significant fashion through an air campaign. And I think they learned very quickly that that wasn't going to happen, which is why you had such a large ground force go in. There was confluence of interest between the United States and Israel in the initial days of the campaign. I think the United States saw a denigration of Hezbollah military capabilities being in its interest, and I think that in part this is what drove the U.S. to provide Israel with additional time to achieve some military gains. At the same time, though, the losses on the ground force have undermined Israeli deterrent capability even further. This is not 1982. Israel is very good at doing these sort of large military campaigns with against traditional armies, which is why they were so successful against Syria. And I think Syria played this very well. They continued to try and rearm Hezbollah all through the campaign and stayed out of the fray. And Israel did not want to enlarge this war to include Syria and or Iran.
So there hasn't been a direct enlargement of the war, but there's a lot of talk about proxy war. Daniel Levy, we heard it from Stephen Erlanger, the New York Times correspondent, just at the top of this hour, a sense in Israel that there's what people are calling it, the war beyond the war. How do you look at that? Charles Krauthammer saying America wants, America needs a decisive Hezbollah defeat, and of course he means delivered by Israel. Was that a proper expectation to set on this conflict, and how has it shaped the conflict, or has it?
I think that Israeli and American interests and values often and importantly are aligned. I do, though, think that Israel has its own set of interests and expectations, and I wouldn't go too far in this direction of the proxy war. First of all, let's be very clear, defending our northern border, securing our northern border is a clear interest. No one has to tell Israel that it's someone else's interest to guarantee our defence in the north. There are very serious questions being asked if this was the right kind of campaign. Was the ground invasion too little, too late? Was, in fact, the entire response misguided? Israel used to have a position of that we will respond to terror at a place and time of our choosing. Mm. In many ways, this was a place and time of Hezbollah's choosing. So that's on one side of the Israeli equation. On the other side of the equation, Hezbollah clearly has a close relationship with Iran, whether it be in terms of financing, in terms of equipping, in terms of the physical presence, apparently, of Iranian Revolutionary Guards. But Hezbollah is not simply a proxy army of the Iranians. That's too simplistic. We won't understand the enemy we're confronting if we only see them like that. Hezbollah is a apparently genuine, integral part and political representative of the Shia community in Lebanon. I think, obviously, once you got into a military confrontation, there was this sense of there being an American ally and an Iranian ally, and it being important to see how certain of the weapons and other things played out on the battlefield. I think the important question we should be asking is, how did we reach a situation where we almost have a bipolar Middle East in terms of powers, US, Iran? And what are the policies that we should have been pursuing and that we should be questioning that allowed us to reach that situation of a hardline Iran being so strengthened? How do we reverse that situation? And that takes us back to questions of, should we look again at Syria and Syria irretrievably being in the Iranian axis? Should we look again at our failures to attempt Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking? And, of course, the Iraq situation.
But what about Israel and the U.S.? You've written about what you described as disentangling Israeli interests from the rubble of neocon creative destruction. You wrote, there is no logic in the country, that is Israel, volunteering itself for the front line of an ideologically misguided and avoidable war of civilizations. You're quoting there Newt Gingrich talking about a third world war to defend civilization and so on. Is that the backdrop you're pointing to? Is that the proxy war framework you're complaining about?
Well, what I'm saying is that there is, it's not the only strand, but there is an influential strand that feeds into American Middle East policies today that, as an Israeli patriot, I can argue that it does not serve Israeli security and Israeli interests. Americans will have to decide whether the last few years have strengthened American security and strengthened American interests in the region. But from the Israeli perspective, I would say that what we've seen in terms of the strengthening of Iran, in terms of America finding itself in somewhat of an Iraqi quagmire, in terms of Syria having been pushed further and further into the Iranian orbit, in terms of not having taken the opportunities, whether it was a Saudi peace initiative, whether it was the death of Arafat, or whether it was Israel's willingness to withdraw from territory, not having taken any of those opportunities to weave together a new peace process, none of that has served the Israeli interest. And the last thing that Israel needs is to be placed at the forefront of a war of civilizations that I genuinely believe is avoidable, would be terrible for Israel. Ultimately, one day, I imagine there are no longer going to be 130,000 American troops in Iraq. But Israel, all its troops and all its civilians, are still going to be in the Middle East. We're going to have to live here in the long term, and our interest is in creating a more stable region, and a region in which radicals, hardliners, extremists are on the downturn rather than the opposite.
David Shenker, how do you see that? Here's Daniel Levy saying, look, I'm an Israeli patriot, and I see that there should be daylight, even a gulf between a kind of neocon clash of civilizations in the Middle East. And you got Charles Krauthammer saying, go for it, go. Now President Bush saying, the stakes are larger than just Lebanon. I firmly believe it's Hezbollah is backed by Iran, encouraged by Iran. Is this a moment to look for stability or a moment to go for the big win, David?
Listen, the U.S. and Israel have shared interests, no doubt, shared values, and are facing many of the same enemies in the Middle East. I think that our interests diverge at times. Clearly, the level of civilian damage, for example, in Lebanon was not in U.S. interests. After all, we support the government of Lebanon, the Sinoa government, and the strides that they've taken in recent months. They are democratic, they're pro-Western, and this campaign weakened them. So that's not in our interest. At the same time, however, as Deputy Secretary of Defense Armitage said some time ago, Hezbollah is the A-team of terrorism, which means essentially that they are more capable, and they have America in their crosshairs, as well as Western interests. They serve as a proxy of sorts for Iran. But the larger issue, really, is that Israel is a responsible actor. They are grown-ups. This is a state that can make its own decisions. We didn't force them to do anything in Lebanon. They asked, I believe, they asked the United States administration for time. The administration granted them some time. And they were ineffective in what they tried to do, apparently. In a wider sense, I also believe that what the neocons, quote-unquote, or the administration is supporting in the Middle East is essentially democratization. And it's the belief of the administration that democracy is the antidote to this type of radicalism. You can argue, I think educated people can differ on the means or the quickness in which you push certain states and the tools of leverage that you employ to achieve more democratic government. But it is the philosophy of the administration that this is the solution over time. And I think that there has also been in the past a serious divergence between the United States and Israel on this regard. After all, Israel was a state that brought in Arafat and supported him for years as he repressed ruthlessly the Palestinian people. And I think, in part, the reason why you have Hamas today in the Palestinian Authority is because Israel really supported Arafat unconditionally for all those years, creating tremendous resentment. I don't think this administration really tried to move away from that very quickly. And I think that that in the long term, this will be a more positive solution both for the Palestinian people and for Israel, having a responsible actor as a neighbor.
Lots of interest running through this conflict. Condoleezza Rice talking about birth pangs of a new era in the Middle East. Lots of blood here as well. Hard to tell exactly where the interests are confluent and where they're not. Let me turn to our callers. Mahmet is calling from Alexandria, Virginia. Mahmet, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to say that this is a conversation we're having 23 years too late.
What do you mean?
If I may just correct a few things. First of all, Ahmadinejad is the leader of the Iran's single-party Hezbollah. The Iranian regime is run by Khamenei, who is the all-powerful leader of Iran and Hezbollah, and they always say Iran is Hezbollah and Hezbollah is Iran. That's the number one.
Mohammed, what is 23 years too late? What are you referring to?
Well, right now, Iran is got all of the government of Iraq works for the Iranian-created Islamic Revolution of Iraq. The entire military, the best people we're getting as volunteers in the military we're recreating when we threw away the known commodity of the Saddam military, are agents who have been trained by Iran for 20 years to join to do this sort of stuff.
So if it's a proxy war in some degree, who's winning, Mohammed?
Well, wait a minute. We're fighting Iran in Iraq. We're fighting Iran in Lebanon. We're fighting Iraq in Afghanistan.
Who's we?
We is the United States.
We haven't had troops in Lebanon.
No, but we are fighting Iran. But we are fighting Iran through our ally in Lebanon.
Who's winning?
Oh, Iran. Iran is also using Afghanistan's drug trade. You know, Iranian government is one of the most heavily involved governments in the drug trade, and we keep talking about them fighting drugs. The Iranian government also has 30,000 agents in South America, which they're going to use for the safest route to get anything inside the United States, which is through the drug trade.
Thanks for your call. Daniel Levy, Mahmet says, just casually, Iran's winning. I heard you say something related or similar. I mean, in the big fight here, who's gaining ground?
Well, this is my concern, and this is where I think we need a reversal on several fronts. In terms of the Iranian situation, one choice would be to do nothing in the face of the Iranian efforts to acquire weapons of mass destruction. I think that would be irresponsible. Another would be to launch a military strike. I don't think that's seriously on people's agenda currently, and I think for good reasons.
Bob's calling from Boston. Hi, Bob, you're on the air.
Hi. I think the U.S. has definitely lost this bout, but I think the neocons have won, because we've seen ever since President Bush got into power, there seemed to be a policy of creating more wars. And let's not forget that an American president, before leaving office, made a historical speech of warning the American public of the military-industrial complex. And I think the more war, the better for that complex to sell guns, weapons. And we've seen that in Iraq. We've seen it in the swelling of the deficit, how much money is being spent on the military in peacetime.
And yet there's a threat. Let us look at it, Bob. Thanks very much for your call. I'm joined from Tel Aviv by Daniel Levy, director of the Middle East Initiative at the New America Foundation and Century Foundation. From Washington by David Schenker, senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And right now from Washington by George Perkovich. He's vice president for studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Mr. Perkovich, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
How do you see this moment? Here we are at the ceasefire. There's a lot of talk about bigger interests at play here through Israel, through Hezbollah. Who's won? Who's lost? Where do we stand?
Well, I think Daniel and David both made very important points that Israel clearly has its own genuine interests in this conflict, and clearly Hezbollah did as well. But there is a broader context in which the U.S. Shares interests with Israel, in particular concern about Iran's nuclear weapon program, or its alleged nuclear weapon program, its support of terror and violence against those who are more amenable to coexistence with Israel. And Iran clearly has interests in this conflict, insofar as it has seen Hezbollah as a major deterrent against the possible U.S. or Israeli military strikes over Iran's nuclear program.
Because so they could dump rockets into Israel if there was an attack on Iran.
Well, they said they've made this clear, Iranian leaders. Look, if you, the United States or Israel, attack Iran to destroy its nuclear program, we have a deterrent in place. We have deterrents in place throughout the region, and Israel will be the first to suffer. I don't think people believe that this is something Iran and Hezbollah wanted to have happen now, in the sense of this kind of conflict and expending these weapons. But clearly those weapons were there for a reason. They've been there a long time. They're sophisticated, and it was part of an Iranian deterrent strategy to protect its own nuclear program. That issue hasn't been addressed now in this conflict, but it's going to be.
Has not been addressed, meaning the Hezbollah threat on Israel's northern border is still there, or the bigger nuclear issue?
The bigger nuclear issue. In other words, this broader context in which Israel and the United States and Iran are contesting. I mean, actually, if you think about it from Israel's point of view, this kind of war with Hezbollah was very serious, obviously. But the big existential threat for Israel is the Iranian nuclear program. And that's the biggest picture. That's what Israelis were most concerned about over the last couple of years, was how do you stop the Iranian nuclear program going forward.
But they haven't gone for that. I mean, American neocons have called for doing that. Bill Kristol famously, Michael Ledeen wrote just not long ago, the battle against Hezbollah is part of the broader war. Israel's now conducting that battle. He wrote, it's a wondrous window of opportunity. Let's go for it. You said a couple days ago, before the ceasefire, George Perkovich, that you haven't been this depressed about circumstances in a long time. What do you mean by that?
it's true. What I mean by that is that this was a horrible conflict. It was horrible for everyone involved, especially Lebanese and Israeli civilians. But it's part of a bigger mess that includes the Iranian nuclear program. It includes Iraq. It includes basically the failure in many Arab states to have leaders who, indigenous, genuinely popular leaders who hold a prospect for their own country's development and education. We have spent power in the United States, a president who's weak, an administration that's tired, a military that's basically been decimated in Iraq. We have Tony Blair on the way out and weakened. So if you look around the world and you say, well, where is the leadership that can try to figure out how to kind of get control over this really complex web of problems, it's not apparent at all, and yet the problems keep growing and becoming more complex, and you get the extremists like Ahmadinejad and others in the region who espouse violence, and then you get crazy statements by people like Michael Ledeen in the U.S. saying, oh, great, another war and we're going to win. Is if they haven't been paying attention the last 3 years to how this all has been going. So that's pretty depressing.
And last night, Iran's Ahmadinejad on CBS 60 Minutes with Mike Wallace looking pretty darn confident, I'd have to say. Daniel Levy, maybe this brings us back to your point on how to deal with Iran. Take us back to the end of your list there, if you'd be good enough, in Tel Aviv.
I think I still remember now.
I hope so.
I think what George just said is absolutely right, that the thing that really concerns Israelis, and here very much there's a shared interest with the US, is the Iranian question. And he's also right in the depressing picture he painted, that sometimes reminds one of a kind of gambler's syndrome, where you give me one, give me another military attack, give me another roll of the dice, and we'll do it this time. The fourth option, which I think is something we should be looking closely at, or putting in there in the mix, is in addition, or to buttress any kind of sanctions effort, is how do you begin to remove some of the cards that we have unintentionally, I imagine, placed in the Iranian hardliners' hands that have strengthened them? As was just mentioned, one of the things is clearly going to be, and in its American question, to look again at the Iraq situation, which has clearly given Iran a playground and a dangerous one to play in. The Afghanistanian situation the previous listener talked about with the drugs thing, I won't go into further. On the Syrian front, One of the things that you're hearing increasingly in Israel, although far less in Washington, is should one be looking again at whether one cannot try and break Syria away from that Iranian orbit? And then the other point, and I think it's a crucial one that's almost not been mentioned that thus far, and that is the Israeli-Palestinian question. Now, some people turn around and say, ah, but really you're saying that we should appease the Palestinians and the Arabs by offering Israel up on a plate and forcing peace down their throats. It's the opposite. The Israeli interest is to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict for reasons that have got to do with guaranteeing Israel's future, Israel's security, and Israel as a Jewish democracy. But when you look at the regional picture, if you can remove that as a mobilizing rallying cry that the extremists and Iran foremost amongst them use, I would say abuse, then I think we've gone at least a significant way to removing some of the attraction of their cry. I'd say one other thing, by the way, for Israel coming out of this Lebanon situation is that Israel needs to be focusing militarily in its planning, in its resources, in what we think about in our military planning, about the real kind of threats we face, rather than continuing what are essentially policing missions in the Palestinian territories. And I think that's harmed us, and we need to end that, and we need to go back to Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking.
So go for a solution there, but it's been very heavy policing while the world has been watching Lebanon, of course. David Shenker, I want to come to you on that, but let me first turn to Madeline, calling from Yonkers, New York. Hi, Madeline. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to say that as an American citizen and taxpayer, that I'm quite distraught over the use of tax dollars to enact this type of so-called war. And I wish that we could refrain from it as being a war, because it's more like political cleansing as opposed to a real declared war.
Well, what do you call it when Hezbollah's raining rockets in? Israeli jets are zooming all over the place. Troops are all over the place, guerrillas and regular. It looks like war.
It's like war, but no real war has been declared. And then if that's the case, what happened to the Geneva Conventions where you tried to protect civilians in war? Look at the infrastructure of Lebanon and how the country has been destroyed.
Yeah, pretty well shattered. Madeline, we've got the gist of that. David Shenker, how do you see this meeting? On the one hand, there's a kind of, you know, everyone's eyes are opened wide at the moral implications here on all sides. Lebanon just shattered. Israelis living in bomb shelters. I mean, people have really been disturbed by that. You can hear it in Madeline's voice. On the other hand, you know, these are real forces at work here, real military forces, a real fight. What's the balance in that? Do you have to stand down because the moral cost gets too great, or must you go forward because the military threat is too great? We've got nukes in the offing here.
Yeah, I don't think that anyone can downplay the level of suffering for the Lebanese people and for the Israelis. That said, I think the lesson of what we saw this past month in Lebanon and what we're seeing on the Iranian nuclear front is that problems like this don't age well. And in 1996, we had this great Warren Christopher shuttle diplomacy that created a truce between Hezbollah and Israel, essentially. And, you know, then the Israelis withdrew, and Hezbollah armed to the teeth, and this type of conflict was inevitable.
But is the suggestion there that you have to go in and have a resounding military victory to every problem on the map?
No, absolutely not. I think that certainly the Iranian problem may not be a military solution, and I think we're seeing that the Hezbollah problem is not necessarily a military solution. In fact, the international community tried very hard and made great strides in making this a diplomatic solution. They passed UN Resolution 1559. Which called for the disarmament of militias in Lebanon, Hezbollah, and Palestinian militias.
But it bubbled along and bubbled along and never happened. I want to try and get one more call, if I may, David. David is calling from Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. How are you doing?
Well, what do you think?
Well, I never thought I'd want Henry Kissinger back in power, but a grand deal seems like the best bet. You know, with friends like Gingrich and Krauthammer, Israel is really going to be in trouble. The really hopeful thing here is that Hezbollah is not a, you know, uncontrollable errant terrorist force like Al-Qaeda. It's attached to a relatively responsible government, Iran, but more important than that, it's attached to a government like Iran that really has something to lose.
So what's the answer? Are you saying go for Iran, attack Iran?
No, not at all. I mean, you can always do that. But the beauty of this situation is that although our interests are not the same with Israel, we have a tactical, or rather strategic, alliance. And that, you know, rather than attack Hezbollah as they had a month ago, if Israel had made the threat against Iran, and then yet used that to get Iran into a negotiation situation.
So poke straight at the muscle behind it. Daniel Levy in Tel Aviv, how about that? David says, you know, go straight to the heart of this. If it's Iran, let's not mess around.
Well, I think the point here is that we're not giving anyone a prize when we talk to them. And that's where we have to go back. And David mentioned the shuttle diplomacy of 96. I would say we miss that. I would say the fact that the Secretary of State couldn't do shuttle diplomacy and had to return to Washington.
Couldn't find anywhere to land, basically.
Couldn't find anywhere to land. And what good does that do us? I think it really what you saw in 96 was something that very quickly brought this back into proportion, prevented the kind of destruction loss that we've seen on both sides this time around. So I'd say go back to coalition building. Let Resolution 1701 be a reminder that you can still do diplomacy. You talk to the people you disagree with. You don't say they know what we think, and take a stance of righteous indignation. That doesn't get us anywhere. Mm. Certainly not on this question.
Well, for the moment at least, the jet's quiet, the rocket's not raining, a time for everybody to think this through. Daniel Levy in Tel Aviv, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you, Tom.
And David Shenker in Washington, D.C., senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Mr. Shenker, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
And George Perkovich, also in Washington, vice president for studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. George, thanks for being along.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.